Bells Tells, The Village Voice, July 16, 1979, by Arthur Bell. In July 1975, I attended a film class at the New School. Director William Friedkin was the guest speaker. He discussed how we prepared for each project before beginning production. With The Exorcist, he visited the town where the actual exorcism took place and spoke with folk who lived there when it happened. Before The French Connection, he hung out with cops and was pounced on by two black Muslims in Harlem, but his lily-white skin was saved from physical harm by a black actor, to whom he is eternally grateful. The summer before The Boys in the Band, Friedkin house-guested with author Mark Crowley on Fire Island because Crowley was more expert on the scene. Friedkin then continued, "I'd never had a homosexual experience. One night we visited the meat rack. It's a gigantic pit with 200 to 300 guys in a daisy chain bawling each other in the ass. One guy got real close to me. He said, 'I think you're cute.' And I turned around and got out of there as quick as my legs could take me." 4 years later, Friedkin hasn't learned much. He's currently shooting Cruising in Manhattan with Al Pacino, Richard Cox, Paul Sorvino, Karen Allen, Michael LaRonin, and Edward O'Neill. His film promises to be the most oppressive, ugly, bigoted look at homosexuality ever presented on the screen. The worst possible nightmare of the most uptight straight, and a validation to Anita Bryant's hate campaign. It'll negate years of positive movement work and may well send gays running back into the closet and precipitate heavy violence against homosexuals. I implore readers, gay, straight, liberal, radical, atheist, communist, or whatever, to give Friedkin and his production crew a terrible time if you spot them in your neighborhood. The film will be shooting for the next 7 weeks at Badland, the Eagle's Nest, the Underground, Police Plaza, and on Christopher and West Streets. And I urge gay men whom Friedkin had signed on as extras and bit players in scenes to be shot at backroom bars, piers, bathhouses, and village streets to be aware of the consequences of his project. Owners of gay establishments would do well to tell Friedkin to fuck off when he comes around to film an exploit. The screenplay, written by Friedkin and loosely based on Gerald Walker's 1970 novel, deals with a cop's search through New York's gay underground for a man who mutilates and decapitates homosexuals. The cop eventually discovers that he himself is gay, and his identification with the killer slowly grows. The film begins with a shot of a tugboat pulling a decapitated body out of the Hudson. Soon after, we get shots of cops discovering another corpse at Central Park's Rambles. The script has no social value. Everyone comes out looking bad. Cops, gays, even the city. The latest script of Cruising is more difficult to come by than knowledge of Skylab's crashing sites. Pacino has asked for revisions. Gerald Walker has not seen any version of the script yet. Naturally, the gay organizations have been forbidden a gander. Last week, they shot 2 days at the city morgue and an afternoon at the Rambles. When they hauled a dummy body out of a van and placed it near last summer's bat-beating sit, a feeling of nausea overtook me. Paul Sorvino said, "I don't know how a gay person will react to Cruising, not being one myself, but the screenplay shows a truthful, tragic series of occurrences. No one can deny that gay psychopaths commit murder and that straight psychopaths beat up on gays. I've covered a few of those stories. That's not the problem with Cruising. The problem is Friedkin. If Sidney Lumet, Paul Mazursky, and Robert Altman, all whom have a compassionate understanding of the human condition, were to write and direct Cruising, I wouldn't be writing this column. Friedkin's motivations for Cruising, I'm sure, would titillate Kraft Ebbing. He's not only playing with a keg of dynamite, he's throwing a match to it." My name is Anthony King, and I'm telling the stories behind your favorite cop movies. This is the all-new Neon Badges. William Friedkin was born in Chicago, Illinois, to Jewish immigrants from Ukraine. He attended public schools, barely receiving grades good enough to graduate, but played basketball well enough to consider turning pro. As a teenager, he started going to the cinema and developed a love for storytelling. He graduated high school at the age of 16 and began working in the mailroom at WGN-TV. Within 2 years, he started directing live TV shows and documentaries, including The People vs. Paul Crump, about an inmate on death row for robbery and murder. That documentary received much acclaim and actually factored in the commutation of Crump's death sentence. As a young adult, Billy ate up as much cinema as possible. Films like Well, Citizen Kane, Clouseau's Les Diaboliques, and The Wages of Fear, and Hitchcock's Psycho became a major influence in his life and career. And speaking of Hitch, after doing a few more documentaries, Billy got a phone call asking him to meet with Alfred Hitchcock. Hitch had seen Billy's work and wanted him to direct an episode of the Alfred Hitchcock Hour. Billy jumped at the chance and directed one of the last episodes of the show in 1965 called Off Season. Having got his first taste of Hollywood, Billy made his move from the Midwest to California and quickly found work. His first feature was Good Time, times, basically a movie version of the Sonny and Cher Comedy Hour, which is unwatchable, according to Billy. He followed that up with an unpublished script by Harold Pinter called The Birthday Party and The Night They Raided Minsky's, featuring Jason Robards and a young Elliot Gould in one of his first roles, followed by the boys in the band. Billy started to worry he'd be pigeonholed as an art house director or documentarian, though. He really wanted to make action movies and serious dramas about an America upended by crime, hypocrisy, the occult, and amorality. And then in 1971, he got his chance with The French Connection, which was nominated for 8 Oscars, ultimately winning 5 for Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, Best Adapted Screenplay, and Best Film Editing. With a crime film, box office success, and an Oscar under his belt, Billy moved on to the occult with The Exorcist in 1973. While not as much of a critical smash as The French Connection, The Exorcist still dominated the box office and ended up with 10 Oscar nominations while winning 2.
Fuck him!
Be gone!
Fuck him, Garrus!
From
fuck
this
him.
Creature of God!
Billy was now considered part of the new Hollywood, a changing of the guard in a sense, where new, younger, and edgier directors were coming in and taking the place of guys like Ford, Houston, Wells, and Capra. This new Hollywood consisted of guys like Bogdanovich, Coppola, Allen, Penn, Peckinpah, and of course, Billy Friedkin. Along with Bogdanovich and Coppola, Billy formed the Directors Company under the Paramount Pictures umbrella. These three visionary directors had free rein to produce whatever they wanted, just so long as it wasn't one of their own films. So they'd go through scripts, pick which ones they liked best, and throw some money towards them to get it made. Ironically, one of the scripts they passed on was a little space epic by their friend George Lucas called Star Wars. They just didn't see it doing anything big at the box office, so, like idiots, they passed on it. Billy was getting bored, though, and left the Directors Company, which was soon after closed by Paramount. And then, as one of the torchbearers of New Hollywood, someone who was allowed to do anything he wanted, a cinematic outlaw, Billy went and made the most ambitious film of his entire career. To get any film made is an absolute miracle. To get Sorcerer made? Well, God herself had a hand in the mix. I'm hard-pressed to think of any other 3-film run as strong as Billy had here. The French Connection, The Exorcist, Sorcerer. Naturally, though, all good things must come to an end, and Sorcerer infamously bombed, and I still don't feel like it's gotten its due. After the financial apocalypse of Sorcerer, Billy made a little crime comedy with Peter Falk called The Brinks Job, which also proved to be a financial failure. After 2 bombs in a row, Billy was on the thinnest ice imaginable. Any sane person would play it safe. Go small, stay under the radar, and try to get into the good graces of the hands that feed you once again. But Billy wasn't interested in making safe hits. He was interested in stories that were moving, provocative, and extremely edgy. So he headed off to New York City and turned the city, and specifically the gay community, on its head. In 1970, Stein and Day published Gerald Walker's novel called Cruising. It was about an undercover cop hunting for a serial killer in the gay community. Billy's producer of The French Connection, Phil D'Antoni, had optioned the book, so he and Sonny Grosso, the real-life detective on whom Roy Scheider's character was based, tried to work up a treatment to sell to studios. Nothing came together, though, and producer Jerry Weintraub, another friend of Billy's, bought the rights. Weintraub was a concert promoter with clients like Frank Sinatra, Elvis Presley, Neil Diamond, Led Zeppelin, and John Denver. He was brash, confident, fast-talking, and a natural salesman. Weintraub understood how show business worked and how to work the politics of it all. He thought Billy would be interested in adapting and directing the book and sent it to him. By this time, though, the book was severely dated. The situation of the gay bars had changed, and part of that scene had transitioned into leather bars. Walker's book just didn't capture that, and Billy had no interest. So Weintraub tossed the rights to the book in a desk drawer and basically forgot about him. 3 years later, Billy started reading articles about mysterious deaths happening in the leather bars. Arthur Bell, who you may remember from the top of the show, was a columnist for The Village Voice, chronicling the gay community in New York City. Bell had a series of graphic articles published about these unexplained deaths and murders. Now, remember, this is the late 70s and AIDS didn't have a name yet. Gay cancer, as it was called before the CDC officially diagnosed acquired immunodeficiency syndrome, was hardly even uttered at this time. Nevertheless, gay men were dying mysteriously, as well as being murdered in the S&M clubs of the meatpacking district in Manhattan. On top of Bell's articles in The Voice, Billy read about body parts found floating in the Hudson. The unexplained deaths and the brutal murders aroused my curiosity, he says.
The devil was at work.
And then Billy read in the New York Daily News about a man named Paul Bateson who was charged with several killings of gay men. The paper referred to him as the trash bag killer. In that article was Bateson's lawyer's name, so Billy called the lawyer and asked if he could meet with Bateson. At this time, Billy wasn't considering doing anything with this. If you listen to him speak or read his memoir, you'll see that he's just a curious guy. And as it turns out, Bateson was in The Exorcist. The scene where Reagan goes to the neurology lab, Bateson was the tech assistant working at the hospital. So Billy calls the lawyer, asks to meet with his client, and the lawyer agrees. So Billy goes to Rikers. Sitting across a metal table from Bateson, he asks right up front, "Paul, did you kill these people?"
"I don't remember. I must have been really high. I remember that guy from Variety."
Addison Verrill, theater critic for Variety.
"I picked him up at the mineshaft and took him to my apartment. We had sex, got stoned. I remember hitting him over the head with the frying pan. Then I guess I chopped him up."
"Why?"
I don't know."
Prior to all of this, Billy had become close friends with Randy Jurgensen, a detective for the NYPD turned technical advisor and actor who had worked on and appeared in The French Connection, Sorcerer, and The Brinks Job. Billy had gone on ride-alongs with Jurgensen and calls him one of the best and most proficient street cops he ever knew. Jurgensen would take Billy to spots where a lot of these murders occurred, like the St. James Motel. He told Billy about the Pussy Posse, cops who patrolled 12th Street and Little 12th Street and would harass members of the private gay clubs. And as it turns out, Jurgensen had even been assigned to go undercover in the gay bars and try to catch the killer, or killers, committing these crimes. Jurgensen would take Billy to these spots he went as an undercover, telling stories about how he lived in that world for months and how it ultimately fucked up his head. So between Arthur Bell's articles, his meeting with Paul Bateson on Rikers, and Randy Jurgensen's real-life stories of going undercover in the leather bars, Billy's mind sprang to life. If he could make this story the way he wanted to and do a completely original take, he'd be interested in climbing this mountain. So he called his old friend Jerry Weintraub. "Jerry, you still on cruising?"
"Yeah, why?"
"I think I know how to do it." Now, Billy knew how to make a crime movie. What he didn't know was anything about the leather scene. So Weintraub introduced him to a man called Uncle Mort, a retired homicide detective who owned a limousine company. In his spare time, Uncle Mort did things for Matty the Horse Ionello, the boss of the Genovese crime family. Matty the Horse controlled massage parlors, whorehouses, and peep shows in Times Square in Midtown, and the Mine Shaft, a private gay leather bar in the meatpacking district. Uncle Mort introduced Billy to Matty the Horse, and one weekend, Billy went out to Long Island to visit. He remembers sitting in the kitchen as Matty the Horse is slicing up salami and cheese for breakfast. Billy says, "I need your permission to film in the mine shaft." Matty the Horse stops slicing, slowly looks up at Billy, raises a finger to his mouth, and says, "Shh," and goes right back to slicing his meat and cheese. A little while later, they're walking to Billy's car, and Matty the Horse says, "Don't talk to me about my business in my house, kid. They got the place wired. Now, does this have anything to do with my business?" Billy says, "It's fiction, Matty, a murder mystery." So Matty the Horse gives Billy a number to memorize, says to call it in 2 days, and ask for Wally. Wally, as it turns out, was the manager of the mine shaft. He tells Billy,
"This is a private club. No aftershave, sneakers, or designer shit. No women, no camera. It's jockstrap night, so you need to check your clothes at the door and strip down to your jocks."
Matty the Horse also suggested Uncle Mort go with Billy that first night, just so no one got hassled. Billy recalls, "That night we saw men of all races, colors, and social statuses mingling as equals. Every conceivable male-on-male sexual fantasy was being fulfilled, and though they involved degradation, they were consensual, not exploitive." And when Uncle Morton and Billy left the mineshaft that night, neither one spoke for a long time. After that, Billy returned to the mineshaft several times. He became friendly with the managers and regulars. He and Jerry also visited the Ramrod, the Eagle's Nest, and the Anvil. And as it turns out, Jerry knew some of these people. It was as if they were leading dual lives. They were stockbrokers, shop owners, and salesmen by day. And at night, well, let's just say there was Crisco involved. And just like that, Billy knew how to write his story. He knew this script was going to be controversial and possibly offend, well, everyone. But for him, the clubs and that lifestyle were just an exotic background for a simple murder mystery. He wrote the script in 4 weeks, and almost immediately Warner Brothers became interested. Weintraub took the script to Warners, who were eagerly awaiting, and after reading it, promptly rejected it. Billy knew exactly what the executives in Hollywood thought. He says, "I became painfully aware of the homophobia, exploitation, and humiliation of the gay community, and I wanted my script to reflect that. I wrote what I saw in the clubs, avoiding, of course, references to the mafia or ex-cops who were the nominal owners of these clubs, but I chose this world because I found it fascinating." Billy is drawn to that closed-off male environment. Police officers, priests, private gay clubs, locker rooms, etc. He was fascinated by the ambiguity of the story as well, as there was never a true resolution to the real-life murders. That's what he wanted to depict. And it's no secret to anyone in the know that Billy Friedkin thrived on controversy and conflict. Weintraub knew this. "That's why I love Billy," he says. "It had to have a director that wouldn't quit. That's Billy Friedkin." So both agreed to take less money in order to co-own the negative with whatever studio ended up buying the script. And lo and behold, they got a meeting. Now, Lorimar Television was about to go into film, so its founder, Merv Adelson, called Billy and Weintraub in for a meeting. Lorimar was mostly known for family fairs such as The Waltons and Eight is Enough, Perfect Strangers, Full House, that type of stuff. So the irony of Lorimar possibly producing a film about a gay serial killer in the leather bars of New York City didn't escape any of them. So Billy and Weintraub met with Adelson, and they were up front with him. They planned to pull no punches. "What you read is what you'll see." Adelson agreed, with the only stipulation being they had to get an R rating. And now Cruising was this much closer to becoming a reality. Billy wasn't too concerned about filling in the cast for his film, but he knew he needed the perfect person to play the lead of Steve Burns, the detective who goes undercover. He had envisioned Richard Gere to play Burns. Gere was quickly becoming a household name, and Billy especially loved him because he possessed a toughness as well as an ambiguous quality. Two things needed for the role of a cop disappearing into the hardcore gay world. So the two met and got along splendidly. Gere loved the script and verbally agreed to star in the picture. But then Stan Kamen, who was the head of the William Morris Agency, called and said,
"Pacino read your script. He loves it and wants to do it."
What were they going to do? Weintraub called Billy.
"It's Al Pacino, Billy."
"Yeah, but Richard Gere is perfect for this part."
"Billy, Pacino."
Weintraub was right. It was Al Pacino, and he wanted to do their movie. So Lorimar and United Artists offered Pacino $3 million, which was a huge salary back in those days. The budget for Cruising had been set at $7 million, and Billy and Weintraub had cut a deal that if they spent less than the $7 million, they could keep the leftovers plus receive percentage points of the profits. There was a caveat, though. They were shooting on completion, meaning if they went over budget, it would come out of Billy and Weintraub's pockets. And now, nearly half their budget was spoken for by one single actor.
Hoo-ah!
Alfredo James Pacino was born in East Harlem and grew up in the Bronx. As a kid, he wanted to be a professional baseball player, but he also had a knack for acting. So he auditioned for the prestigious High School of the Performing Arts and was accepted. His mother hated the idea of her son being involved in the arts, though, and after several arguments, Pacino left home. With PA being a private school, he took jobs as a messenger, busboy, janitor, and postal clerk to pay his tuition. He acted in basement plays in the underground theater scene and eventually auditioned for and was rejected by the famed Actors Studio. Instead, Pacino joined the HB Studio. At this point, his classes and non-paying theater gigs were taking up all of his time, so Pacino had no source of income. He was often unemployed and homeless, sometimes sleeping in the streets, sometimes in theaters, sometimes at friends' houses. After 4 years at HB, Pacino once again auditioned for the Actors Studio and this time was finally accepted. There, he studied method acting under Lee Strasberg. Pacino says, "The Actors Studio meant so much to me in my life. Lee Strasberg hasn't been given the credit he deserves. It sort of launched me. That was a remarkable turning point in my life." Pacino started getting bigger and bigger theater gigs, and in 1967 he spent a season at the Charles Playhouse in Boston. In 1968 he starred in Israel Horovitz's The Indian Wants the Bronx at the Astor Place Theater, where he won an Obie Award for Best Actor, along with his future frequent collaborator John Cazale, winning for Best Supporting. In 1969, Pacino made his Broadway debut in Does a Tiger Wear a Necktie at the Belasco Theater. Even though the show closed after only 39 performances, he still won the Tony Award. He won his second Tony for The Basic Training of Pablo Hummel and has been on Broadway several more times in shows like David Mamet's American Buffalo, Glengarry Glen Ross in China Doll, Eugene O'Neill's Huey, and Shakespeare's The Merchant of Venice. While stage work was fulfilling, it wasn't financially rewarding, and in 1969, Pacino made his film debut with a brief appearance in Mean Natalie, alongside Patty Duke. After his debut, he was off to the races with a string of films that rivals any actor to this day. The Panic in Needle Park, The Godfather, Scarecrow, Serpico, The Godfather Part 2, and Dog Day Afternoon. He was one of, if not the biggest name in Hollywood at the time, and he was signed on for Billy Friedkin's next picture.
That was stupid.
Was it?
Now, Pacino knew nothing of the gay scene, let alone the leather bars, so he tells Billy he wants to experience these bars and this lifestyle for the first time on camera, just like his character would be experiencing these things for the first time. Billy responds, okay. Pacino also saw the invaluable resource that was Randy Jurgensen. He drilled Jurgensen with questions constantly. Did you really do this? And what would you be wearing? He became a sponge, soaking in everything he could from Jurgensen. Because whatever Billy wrote in his script actually happened. These events came straight from the sources. Pacino also thought it would be a good idea to look the part, so he scheduled an appointment with a stylist in the city. When he came back to set, he was unhinged.
Look what they did to my hair!
He was no longer Al Pacino. Nobody would recognize him, Billy says. We tried wigs, extensions, nothing worked. So they ended up delaying production so his freaking hair could grow back. And that sweet deal Billy and Weintraub had cut with the studio began to disappear. This was only the start of their problems. Having been published in 1970, the gay community was already aware of Gerald Walker's novel. And as you recall, Arthur Bell seemed to have the vendetta against the production, and specifically Billy. Bell's column was sort of a call to arms for the gay community, and word spread fast. Billy started receiving anonymous death threats. While they had permission to shoot in the mineshaft in the Anvil, other bars started caving to the pressure and pulled their permits. Production hadn't even started yet. Despite all that, Billy had surrounded himself with a dynamite cast and crew. Pacino, of course, was doing the bulk of the heavy lifting on camera, but the rest of the cast was filled out with actors at the top of their game at the time. Paul Sorvino had worked on Billy's previous movie, The Brinks Job. Billy asked Sorvino to play the part of Captain Edelson as if the man had seen the most horrible things imaginable in his line of work. Karen Allen was relatively new, having only appeared in a handful of films up to this point. Billy loved what they saw in her audition. She was so soft and loving, he says. It was a stark contrast to the hyper-male-dominated cast. James Remar had only been in a few films as well. As far as he was concerned, he says this was just a murder mystery with a different kind of backdrop, exactly how Billy saw it. And you had Ed O'Neill in his first role playing a detective along with, of course, Jurgensen and Grosso. And why is that Billy always uses real cops in his films? Because they're cops. They know how to be cops. Why have an actor playing a cop if you can get real cops? Since most of these clubs they'd be filming in were private, the regulars were paid as extras. No actor could be asked, let alone simulate what actually happened in these places. And then, of course, you had Mike Starr and Joe Spinell's The Pussy Posse at the beginning of the movie. And who could forget Powers Booth as the hanky salesman in one of his first roles? For several other roles, Billy turned to stage actors in New York. Two key roles in particular, those of Ted Bailey, the neighbor, and Stuart Richards, the killer, went to Don Scardino and Richard Cox, respectively. Like most directors, Billy only wants to work with actors who will inhabit the character, so he encouraged his actors to go into these clubs they were allowed in and do their research, live the life for a little bit. Cox remembers Billy being lit up. He was in a creative fervor. Like any actor, he'd expect us to come in and be completely prepared and knowing there are lines, and then he'd pull the rug out from under us. Billy likes his actors to be off balance. He wants them fresh and disoriented, and from that he would get authentic performances. Ah yes, authentic performances. Enter Al Pacino. He was enthusiastic at first, Billy admits. Pacino had little knowledge of gay life and wanted to experience everything fresh as his character would, and he was shocked at what he saw in these places. He'd never seen or experienced anything quite like it. During the scenes in the clubs, Pacino wanted to go out in front of the rolling camera and just start improvising. What came out of those instances was someone who was very new and naive to this lifestyle, and it worked perfectly. What Billy didn't expect was Pacino being a complete diva. There'd be an 8 a.m. call. The rest of the cast and crew were there, ready to roll. Pacino, though, wouldn't roll up till 10:30, and then act like nothing was wrong, shaking hands, giving hugs, high-fiving everyone around, and then he'd say, "What are we doing today, Billy?" Pacino had no idea what was on the schedule. The makeup guy told Billy to schedule Pacino at least 2 hours early so he'd show up on time. The Pacino call, he called it. On top of that, Pacino wouldn't even know his freaking lines. Billy can't remember a day he ever knew his lines. Pacino would look at the shooting pages for the day just before getting in front of the camera, and then he would require several takes just to get it right. His lines would be written on cards on the floor or the ceiling, just like Brando used to do. He argued this was the only way to get fresh, authentic performances. Billy, on the other hand, said it's only when you know your lines that you can start to incorporate authentically improvised moments. As shooting continued, Pacino's performances started to really affect Billy's attitude. None of this helped the fact that Billy's first choice for the role was Richard Gere, someone he knew could inhabit the part. The only time Billy saw something he truly loved from Pacino in Cruising was when he burst through the door to confront Remar, and you see Byrne's violent side for the first time. For a scene lasting only a few minutes, Billy says, I could see a flash of his powerful charisma as an actor. Billy's only hope was that he and Bud Smith could make it all work in the editing room.
Hips or lips.
As production moved along, the protests became more and more tumultuous. Crowds of hundreds would gather outside shooting locations, throwing rocks and bottles at the cast and crew, who in turn would throw that shit right back. Protesters would make lots of noise during production. Whistles, shouting, air horns. They'd get access to apartments next door to the apartments production had rented to shoot in and blast their stereos. They'd stand on rooftops with reflectors and screw up DP James Contner's lighting. There'd be chants of, hey, hey, ho, ho, the movie crew has got to go. The actors would have to be escorted on and off set for protection. Sonny Grosso said he'd never seen the ferociousness of people who didn't want a movie made. Usually there are three or four cops on a movie set for simple security. Cruising had 300, including the entire mounted patrol force of the NYPD. Don Scardino recalls a time he and Pacino were rehearsing in the diner and a huge crowd of protesters gathered out front, shutting down the street and the sidewalk. The actors and crew were basically trapped, so Pacino's bodyguard ends up calling in more people from security to make a wedge through the crowd. Pacino's car pulls up, and he and Scardino run through the wedge and dive into the car. So here's Scardino in the back, he's laughing and he's saying, "This is great!" And then there's Pacino. In the front seat, he's got his head in his hands and he's nearly in tears. And permits continue to be denied for production. Columbia University, for example. So Pacino, Cox, Billy, and a small crew went down to Morningside Heights and stole the shots. They tried to be one step ahead of the protesters whenever possible, but it hardly ever worked out. Weintraub was constantly in meetings every day with community leaders trying to get a hold on the situation. It was a complete nightmare. Billy says the demonstrations were a complete surprise. I understood where the anger was coming from, but I also understood they were trying to shut down free speech. He had no intention of making a statement one way or the other about what was happening in the leather bars. It was simply the background to a key plot point. A murder mystery. Despite all that, Billy saw every film he'd made as an adventure and an education. He remained undaunted by all the pressure, and he never flinched once from his ultimate goal of getting his movie made. Everything in Cruising was shot on location because Billy believes location photography is honest, and each location was selected based on the characters. Billy hired James Contner as his DP after working with him on Brinks. Contner was one of the camera operators on that film, and Billy asked him if he thought he was ready to light a film. Billy and Contner went into the clubs essentially with documentary cameras and filmed whatever they saw. Dancing, drinking, kissing, fucking, fisting, golden showers, everything. For the whole film, but the club scenes in particular, Contner says they succeeded in shooting the film in black and white, but in color. Other locations include the Rambles in Central Park, where gay sex was happening at all hours, the St. James Motel, where one of the actual murders took place, West Village Apartments, and even the City Morgue, where Chief Medical Examiner Michael Baden let them shoot the actual body parts found floating in the river. Mayor Ed Koch found out about this and actually fired Baden later. And then, of course, they filmed at Police Plaza for the scenes in Edelman's office in the interrogation room. And speaking of that, the big, burly black dude in the jockstrap and cowboy hat? That was an actual tactic used by cops to beat confessions out of suspects. And then later, when the suspect was in court, the judge would ask, "Who hit you?" And the suspect would talk about this big black guy in a jockstrap and a cowboy hat, and the judge would just laugh it off as a crazy lie.
Who is that guy?
Production wrapped, and Billy headed to the editing room with his editor from Sorcerer and Brinks, Bud Smith. The first thing they had to do was go back to New York for a month to do ADR, automatic dialogue replacement, or looping. They noticed immediately that much of the sound recorded during production was ruined because of the protesters. In this case, Billy discovered something he hadn't really considered while writing the script. Billy has long said that editing is the most creative part of making a film. He uses the editing room as sort of an experimental bin. There, all the pieces are laid out before you, and you start to mix and match, and sometimes you come across a combination of cuts or a new sequence in which to show different scenes, which can completely alter the story. And sometimes you realize you can add a whole new element to your story using ADR. The question on everyone's minds after Cruising ends is,
who's the killer?
Billy's answer? I don't know who the killer is. There's an X factor out there killing people. At the very end of Cruising, Byrne stares at himself in the mirror and then shifts his eyes to the audience.
When you look at someone, do you really know who they are?
Billy says, there's an attempt not to confuse people intentionally, but to underline the fact that there are multiple killers out there. And in this case, they all look alike with the dark hair and leather getup. So what Billy and Smith decided to do was have one voice actor, James Sartorius, record the voice of the killer and then use that for all the killers and Stewart's father. Whether you think it works or not is totally up to you, but personally, I dig it. Now, Billy knew this was going to have a hard time getting that R rating Lorimar demanded. So what he did was, while shooting at the clubs, he shot everything, remember? So he put that in the cut they sent to the ratings board. Richard Hefner was head of the ratings board at the time. Weintraub did the unusual thing by inviting Hefner to his house for dinner and a private screening. Something you need to understand, Billy says, is that Hefner was conservative in his dress and his opinions. So the three finish dinner and move into Weintraub's little screening room and start the film. Over the next 2 hours, with Billy sitting behind Hefner, the feeling of discomfort filled the room. During the first murder, Hefner squeaks out an "Oh." The film plays on. More groans. Eventually, Hefner removes his jacket and tie. He's mopping his forehead with his handkerchief. 20 minutes in, and Billy's no longer watching the movie. He's watching the poor schlub in front of him.
Oh, God, no!
The movie ends, lights come up, and Hefner has sweated through his entire shirt, and his face is all blotchy.
Good Lord!
And then Weintraub speaks up. What'd you think, dick? Billy will tell you, Richard Hefner was most definitely a Richard and not a dick.
What do I think? Jerry, this is the worst film I've ever seen.
But what's the rating?
The rating? There aren't enough X's in the alphabet for this picture.
You can't do this to me. I got all my money wrapped up in this picture. You gotta help us. What do we have to do to get an R? Now, remember, the cut Hefner had just seen included everything. Billy knew it wasn't the violence. Cruising isn't really a graphically violent picture anyways. He didn't want it to be any more graphic or violent than what you see in Psycho. What's graphic, Weintraub says, is what Billy makes you feel. It's more in your mind. So what Hefner saw was practically a gay porno. In the version we know now, there's a quick shot of a man rubbing Crisco all over his arm up to his elbow. The cut Hefner had just seen showed what that man does with his greased up arm. At this point, Hefner suggests Billy and Weintraub hire the consultant the board uses in these situations. The consultant? Aaron Stern, the man Hefner replaced, and a close personal friend of Billy's. Stern had given The Exorcist an R rating with zero cuts, so Billy felt a wave of relief pass over him. That is until he found out Stern would be charging $1,000 a day. So, 50 grand later, the fisting and the fucking removed, they finally got their R rating. Well, most of the fucking. One thing Billy and Smith did include was some subliminal cuts during the murders when the knife enters the body. Billy always saw those instances representing anal intercourse between two men, so that's what you'll see if you don't blink. Billy knew the sounds and the music of the film would be crucial. The sound should be doing and saying more than the picture, Billy says. So Bud Smith hired Foley artist John Roche to capture these sounds. Heavy leather boots echoing through alleyways, chains and keys clanging, and of course the many and varied sounds of squeaking leather. As for the music, what we hear in the clubs in the film isn't what was really playing. These places were pumping the hits at the time. Disco, Donna Summer, Casey and the Sunshine Band, Sister Sledge, stuff like that. But Billy hated disco with a burning passion. It didn't have that edge he associated with the look of the film. So composer Jack Nitzsche introduced Billy to garage bands cranking out what would eventually become punk rock. Bands like The Germs, Willie DeVille, and Darby Crash were playing the music Billy heard in his head. So he commissioned new songs and included them in the soundtrack. So while we see these guys in the mineshaft dancing to Loneliness by the Cripples, they're probably actually dancing to Disco Inferno by the Tramps. The film was cut and approved, so Billy invited Pacino over for a screening with Bud Smith. Billy and Smith and Weintraub were happy with what they had. So Pacino watches it, the lights go up, he turns, and he says, "We've got a lot of work to do." "What do you mean?" asked Billy.
"I mean, I don't get it. It doesn't work."
"I disagree, Al."
"Well, we'll have to try and fix it."
"Like how?"
"We have to go into the cutting room and start over."
"Let me tell you something. I like the film. I have Final Cut. There's no way I'm going to let you into the cutting room. Is that clear?" Pacino didn't realize he'd end up being a suspect by the end of the film, but Billy had only discovered that detail in the cutting room. Like he said, the editing bay is an experiment. Had he known that all along, he would have told Pacino. The film was all about transformation. Burns potentially being one of the killers was just part of the theme of transformation. Pacino was so pissed, he's never done any publicity for Cruising to this day. first screening for Critics took place on the east side of New York. Billy walked to the theater that night for a Q&A afterwards and ended up running into a friend coming out when the film ended. "Boy, are you in for it," he said. "Good luck." Throughout the film, the audience had erupted into boos and curses, but Billy had expected this. During the Q&A, most of the questions were along the lines of, "Why would you make a movie like this?" Many weren't questions at all. It was just people screaming at Billy, basically calling him a monster in some form or another. And Arthur Bell was there, of course. He'd inch closer and closer to the podium while berating Billy. Grosso and Jurgensen ended up having to actually restrain him.
"You've made a monstrous, evil film!"
So Billy says, "I became aware of these places and events from your columns!" Bell screams back,
"Why don't you pay me then? Why did you rip me off?"
After that screening, the legal department at UA decided to put up a disclaimer at the top of the film as a way to cover their asses. "This film is not meant to comment on or embarrass any particular group of people." It covered no one's ass, of course. And Billy says he started to question himself after that night. "Had I done Cruising simply to stir up controversy? I made it because it was a fresh take on the detective film against a backdrop that had never been seen by a mainstream audience. And it encompassed the themes that continue to fascinate me. Good and evil in everyone. Our conflicting desires. I knew this was a controversial film. I knew it while we were filming it." Cruising opened on February 15th, 1980. Even though it was officially rated R, some cinemas still advertised it as X because they thought they'd received the wrong cut, and the reviews were less than stellar, focusing mostly on the plot holes and sloppy writing. Frank Rich of Time magazine wrote, "By making Cruising, William Friedkin was asking for trouble. This detective melodrama has something to offend almost everyone. The real problem is Friedkin's inability to deliver what should have been a brilliant thriller about sex and death. This film muffles a potentially explosive premise. The film makes good on its ambitions only sporadically. Friedkin is as skilled at capturing the ways of hard-boiled cops as he is at depicting the sweaty haunts of dangerous sex. Still, Cruising's most crucial matters are hopelessly fouled up. As a simple detective story, the film is defeated by narrative loopholes, unconvincing plot twists, and the last-minute injection of a demon who seems to have drifted in half-baked from The Exorcist. The psychological drama is forfeited by the handling of the central character. Though Pacino is in sensitive, even witty form, he just does not have enough to do. Though Cruising may have gone too far for some audiences as it is, it fails as a film by refusing to go far enough." And from Charles Champlin of the Los Angeles Times, "You don't have to be homosexual to dislike Cruising, but the gay community is not wrong to worry that William Friedkin's movie plays like a recruiting poster for an Anita Bryant parade. No one is likely to find the contents anything but gamey, sordid, shocking, and profoundly depressing. Cruising is, I think, largely unsuccessful, measured against what appears to have been Friedkin's creative intentions. The principal complaint, artistically, is that it is not very clear at the rudimentary level of exposition of character and event. The problem, as with Friedkin's Sorcerer, which he also wrote himself, is in a script that never seems sure enough what it wants to say or prove. Friedkin finds himself presenting a murder mystery he can't solve, and telling a sociological story whose point he leaves curiously up in the air. Whatever Friedkin and his producer had in mind for Cruising, they fell short." And finally, Roger Ebert with 2.5 out of 4 stars. "There is a large, loud question right at the center of Cruising, and because the movie lacks the courage to answer it, what could have been a powerful film dissipates its force and leaves us feeling merely confused and annoyed. The question is, how does the hero of this film ultimately really feel about the world of homosexual, sadomasic sex he is assigned to infiltrate? Or, who is the Pacino character and what's he like? We learn so little about this guy, we almost suspect that important scenes have been left out. Whether he does or doesn't have gay sex is central to this story, and the movie makes that obvious. And yet Friedkin looks the other way at crucial moments. Is he afraid to offend anybody? Then why choose this subject? The murder investigation itself is complicated enough on the surface, but careful thought after the movie will reveal that the plot structure is basically a mess. Here's a movie that's well visualized, that does a riveting job of exploring an authentic subculture, that has a fairly high level of genuine suspense from beginning to end, and that then seems to make a conscious decision not to declare itself on its central subject. What does Friedkin finally think his movie is about? Billy believes his timing was off with the release of the film. It was the beginning of the Reagan era, he says, a feel-good period. These ambiguous films I made and loved were passing out of vogue. Rocky, Star Wars, Raiders of the Lost Ark, and Close Encounters were on top. Audiences wanted reassurance and superheroes, not ambiguity. I began to realize that my films came from deep within my psyche. My films are who I am, or at least they are what fascinates me and obsesses me. 30 years later, Quentin Tarantino was asked why Cruising started getting the love it deserved. He says that it now represents a nostalgia for a lifestyle that was there and then gone in a flash because of AIDS. After getting a new scan and a re-release, Billy thinks Cruising has some very interesting sequences. I understand that it's disturbing. That's intentional. And I don't think it's aged too much. I think that it's reflective of the time and what was going on in the world just prior to naming the AIDS epidemic. Whether you like it or hate it, it's very unconventional. All my gratitude belongs to you, the listeners, for your support. I love you all. You can follow me on Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd at AK Donnelly. That's one N, two L's. My name is Anthony King, and I'll see you all next time.